steel-made pottery, wheeled transport, the cylinder seal, and a writing system. They also created an effective system of centralized government, though they still don't seem to have been ruled by kings. Let's look at each of these innovations in turn. Early bronzes weren't made with the classic mixture of copper and tin, for the most part, but instead with copper and arsenic. The arsenic made the bronze much stronger and more useful for tools and weapons than simple copper. Bronze tarnishes to a green patina if it's not polished, but it doesn't rust. And old bronze objects could always be melted down and reformed into something new. It was a wonderful new material. The people of the Uruk period figured out how to cast bronze in molds, so the metal could take just about any shape. It was used to make sculptures, bowls, cups, shields, daggers, razors, knives, mirrors, a vast array of things. The amount of copper imported from the Gulf and from Turkey must have increased enormously to meet the new demand. People didn't stop using stone tools. Those were still needed by many in society, but bronze became the material of choice for people who could afford it. Meanwhile, pottery seems to have lost some of its prestige. If you could eat from a bronze dish, why bother with a ceramic one? The pots made in the Uruk period became less interesting than those from the Ubaid period, perhaps because elite vessels were now made of metal. One kind of simple bowl has been found all over the place in the Uruk period. It's called a beveled rim bowl. These were made in molds and by the thousands. They're coarse and undecorated, almost as though they were made to be used and thrown away. Some scholars think they were used to measure and distribute rations to workers. Other kinds of pottery, jars, dishes, cups, and so on, began to be made in much larger quantities than before, but not in molds like the beveled rim bowls or coiled by hand like the earlier Ubaid pots. Potters started to use the pottery wheel. A sort of mass production replaced the fine handmade ceramics industry of earlier times. It's possible that the invention of the pottery wheel preceded the actual wheel. Wheels seem so obvious that we tend to assume they were invented very early. Think of all those cartoons of a caveman standing next to a big stone wheel. But it's not an obvious development at all. Whole civilizations in other parts of the world managed to grow and thrive without ever inventing the wheel. To be of any use, a wheel needs to be perfectly round and sturdy and securely attached to an axle that won't break. In turn, the axle needs to be attached to a box or carriage and must be able to turn freely without getting jammed. And the whole contraption must be able to turn corners. The invention of the wagon was a marvel, even when the wheels were made of solid wood and the wagon rode on four heavy wheels. A wheeled cart could carry a great deal more cargo than a person could and more cargo than could be put on the back of a donkey. Its closest parallel was a boat. But boats were no help if goods needed to be transported beyond the banks of a river or canal. Cylinder seals began to be used in the Uruk period to identify people who were responsible for the production of goods and their movement. In the Ubaid area that preceded the Uruk period, stamp seals were already being used further north. But once cylinder seals were invented, they became a fixture of Mesopotamian society for the next 3,000 years. They were ingenious. In today's society, we use signatures to attest to things. We sign credit card receipts, contracts, agreements, letters, and so on. A signature is a kind of commitment. In the Uruk period, writing was just beginning, and people hadn't started using it to write names. So no one had a signature. Actually, that was true throughout Mesopotamian history. Even after writing was used extensively, people didn't sign their names. But you could buy a seal or be given one, and you could use this seal to identify things as yours or to note that you had been somewhere and approved something. The seal provided evidence of your involvement, even when you were away. This is a remarkable intellectual development and similar to writing, which developed during this period as well. We'll come back to that in a bit. People who've seen cylinder seals only in photos often assume they were large, but they were tiny, just an inch or two in height. Each one was a cylindrical bead, usually carved out of a hard stone, with a scene engraved in negative relief. When the seal was rolled on clay, the scene appeared as an endless frieze that could cover as much of a surface as you needed. The images repeated over and over. The intricate scenes carved on these earliest cylinder seals, they can take your breath away. When you blow up the image to the size of a book page or a computer screen, you can see an amazing amount of detail. One example shows a shepherd, or perhaps a priest, extending his arms toward a flock of six-horned goats. You can see the plants in the man's hands, the details of his face, his clothes, and his hat. Each of the goats is also carefully depicted. It's astounding that an ancient craftsman, working without a microscope, could have created this perfect little scene in negative relief on the curved surface of a small, hard stone cylinder. In later times, cylinder seals became formulaic, but in the Uruk period, the artists were still experimenting, discovering what could be represented in this new medium. Perhaps the two most important developments of the Uruk period were the creation of a form of government capable of administering a state and the invention of writing. Unfortunately, we don't know all that much about the government other than that it existed and that it used the new writing system extensively to keep records. There are no paintings or statues of kings, no secular palaces dominating cities. There are some small sculptures of bearded men wearing belts. They don't seem to be gods. Gods almost always wore horned helmets in Mesopotamian art. They might well be priests, and perhaps they were in charge of Uruk. Powerful men might have been in charge of each of the major cities that were growing during this period. But these men may well have ruled as representatives of the gods rather than as kings. Each city had a particular god that was believed to live there and watch over it. Perhaps the rulers had a close tie to the city god. Writing was a real breakthrough, even though it might not have seemed so initially. The first written signs weren't attempts to represent language. They seemed to have been memory aids. Just as a cylinder seal could give evidence of the identity of a man who'd sent off a shipment, a picture of a cow or a bushel of wheat could record what was in that shipment. Two marks next to a picture of a cow could indicate that two cows were sent, and so on. For hundreds of years, from about 3200 BCE onwards, this was the type of writing that was done. There's no way to know what language was being represented. A picture of a cow could be read as the word cow in any language at all. Just think of how useful this was, though. With a way to keep track of numbers and commodities, the administration could record taxes or tribute to the temples or rations, anything that was coming in or going out from places of storage. This form of script is known as proto-cuneiform, and it was written down on the same material that had long been used for impressing seals, lumps of clay. The signs were drawn into the clay using a sharp stick or reed. The earliest proto-cuneiform tablets from Mesopotamia were well made, divided neatly into rectangles with straight lines, and filled with the carefully drawn signs that represented numbers and commodities. What could be duller, and yet at the same time more practical? Faced with the impossible task of memorizing mind-numbing sequences of objects and numbers, people invented a tool that eliminated the need for memorization. With writing, they had an easy method with which to recall these things. One problem, though, was that the writing system initially couldn't record the names of people. An ingenious solution was to use the rebus principle, which is an allusional device. Someone's name could be broken up into syllables, with each syllable represented by a picture of the thing that had that name. So, if your name in English was Barbie, you could write the name with a picture of a bar and a picture of a bee. The Sumerian language, which was common in Sumer, the southern part of Mesopotamia, happens to be supremely well-suited to writing this way, because almost all the words were one syllable in length. So for the word for arrow, for example, was T. If you had the sound T in your name, you could represent that syllable with a picture of an arrow. The word T also happened to mean life, so you could write the word life with an arrow as well. This principle made it possible to write just about every word in Sumerian. And now, with signs for sounds, as well as signs for whole words, The writing system could be used to list commodities and record who sent them, along with what was still owed and who had fulfilled a work obligation, all the details that helped a newly urban society to run smoothly. And that, for ages, was enough for writing to do. Centuries passed before anyone thought of writing for a more literary purpose. Throughout Mesopotamian history, most people never learned how to write. A particular group of professionals, whom we call scribes, mastered the process and were employed in keeping records for the leaders of the community. It must have become clear early on that writing needed to be consistent. Each scribe couldn't invent his own sign for cow, so someone must have chosen among the signs that had been created and streamlined the system, rejecting many signs and bringing uniformity. And over many generations, writing did become consistent. It also became more abstract. Gradually, the early picture signs evolved into simpler signs made up of straight lines with wedges at the ends, which could be written much more quickly. Scribes made the wedge-shaped lines by pressing a reed with a rectangular end into clay at a slight angle. The Latin word for a wedge is cuneus. This is why scholars called the Mesopotamian writing system cuneiform. Any cuneiform sign could be read as a syllable or as representing a whole word, called a logogram, like the ampersand or the at sign in our own writing system. Early writing didn't have any punctuation, and scribes didn't put spaces between words. Cuneiform was originally written in rectangular boxes, each of which contained a phrase or coherent unit, such as a number and a commodity. This form of writing included hundreds of signs, each of which had several possible values, depending on its context. It was very complicated. Not only did a scribe need to memorize all the signs, he had to know the spellings of words, which were surprisingly consistent, and the correct legal or administrative terms to use. And he needed to be good at mathematics to do the accounting necessary to keep track of palace inventories or taxes, and later for being able to survey fields and determine their area and to divide up estates. The scribes seem also to have made their own writing materials. Each scribe needed to know where to obtain fine, consistent clay and how to cleanse it so not the smallest impurity would get in the way of the tiny cuneiform signs to be impressed on the tablet surface. He also needed to know how to shape the clay into tablets that would be just the right size for his work and how to determine the exact moment when it was still soft enough to write on, but not so soft that it would end up covered with his fingerprints. Faced with the need to master this vast amount of knowledge and skill, someone must have thought of creating schools in which scribes would be trained. This was probably initially a type of apprenticeship. Just as boys learned from their fathers or from an expert how to farm or make tools, some boys now learned how to write in cuneiform. Very early on, a shared curriculum with the same texts was used in cities from Syria to the Persian Gulf. Long lists of words were put together, forming the core of what each scribe needed to learn in school. These lexical lists have been found in many archaeological excavations, often with the words in exactly the same order. The lexical lists also provide us with a window into the Mesopotamian conception of knowledge. The words define the world, society, and the universe. They were not organized alphabetically. There was no standard order for cuneiform signs. But some lists were organized based on sound. Words that sounded the same in Sumerian, yet might have had different meanings, were grouped together. Other words that started with signs that looked similar were also grouped together. A third type of list had a conceptual framework, grouping words in categories. One list in this group is almost 10,000 lines long and covered several clay tablets. It focused on terms that would have been used frequently by a scribe during his career. The list included legal and administrative terms, trees, wooden objects, reeds and objects made of reeds, clays and objects made of clay, types of leather and objects made of leather, metals, domestic animals, wild animals, cuts of meat, stones, plants and vegetables, birds and fish, textiles, geographic terms, and food and drink. The words in the list were Sumerian, but the list also gave their translations into another local language, Akkadian. Akkadian was the main language in the area right to the north of Sumer, a region called Akkad. This was near modern Baghdad, where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers flowed near one another before separating again. Akkadian is a Semitic language that's related to modern Arabic and Hebrew. Both languages, Sumerian and Akkadian, were spoken in Mesopotamia at least from the very beginnings of writing. It's unclear, however, where these languages originated and how or when the speakers of these languages arrived in the valleys of the Euphrates and Tigris. Archaeologists have found a remarkable thing about this period. The ancient people from around Uruk seem to have set up colonies right across Syria, Iran, and Turkey. There are sites in these distant lands with Uruk-style architecture and pottery, as well as cylinder seals and tools. Unlike the typical interaction in the earlier Ubaid period, when people were merely influenced by one another, the Uruk people seem to have physically moved and settled in the new colonies. On the other hand, they were not building an empire. That didn't happen for centuries. Instead, these early colonies were probably designed to facilitate trade, to get obsidian, copper, lapis lazuli, wood, building stone, and so on, back to the southern Mesopotamian people who really needed it. Three different types of colonies developed. Some southern Mesopotamians built settlements in unoccupied areas. Others conquered existing settlements, and yet others lived peaceably side by side with locals in the places they moved to. Hamukar, an Ubaid period town in Syria, was one of the places conquered by the Uruk people from the south. Archaeologists have found evidence of buildings that were burned down and walls that toppled. An excavator described the scene vividly. He said, "The attack must have been swift and intense. Buildings collapsed, burning out of control, burying everything in them under vast piles of rubble." The excavator noted that this is the earliest known evidence of organized warfare, and that it helped the Uruk people take over. New buildings were built on top, in the Uruk style, on top of all that debris. Amazingly, the Uruk people seem even to have been in contact with Egypt, hundreds of miles away. Around this time, Egyptian tombs were built using the Mesopotamian niche and buttress style of architecture. Egyptians also began to use cylinder seals, and Mesopotamian boats appeared in Egyptian art. Egypt was rich in gold, which might have made it an appealing place to Mesopotamian traders. It's unlikely that the Uruk people tried to set up a colony there, but they do seem to have been in contact. Maybe Egyptians even traveled to Mesopotamia. For some reason, this brief flurry of contact ended quickly, and for centuries after the Uruk period, the Egyptians and Mesopotamians appear to have been weirdly unaware of one another's existence. So to sum up, if you had lived in Uruk around 3200 BCE, you might have guessed that you were living in the most advanced civilization that had ever existed up to that point. And you would have been right. Humans were controlling the landscape and the built environment more successfully than ever before. They did so under a new form of state that might have been led by religious rulers, priests perhaps, and which used writing to keep the administration running smoothly.
Lecture 6, Mesopotamia's First Kings and the Military.
The birth of Prince George of Cambridge in July 2013 provided people with an experience shared by humans across the world and across 5,000 years of history. As soon as we were told his name, we knew we would see it and see his face for the rest of our lives. Prince George would be growing up in the public eye, and the world would watch and discuss him for generations to come. Although for most of us, our careers and futures are mysteries from birth, that's not true of a crown prince. His path is laid out for him. He will be king. He'll be watched and analyzed, and sometimes applauded and sometimes scorned throughout his life. Prince George's experience is a relic of past centuries. He's a living history exhibit, a link to a time when kings had the power to decide almost anything. A new prince in line for the throne provided a promise of continuity, even if the royal family was unpopular. No other child was so scrutinized. The same will almost certainly be true for Prince George, even though British royalty no longer has the power to decide things for the country. I remember once seeing the royal family go by in a car in the Lord Mayor's show. That's an annual parade in London. And being quite sure that Prince Andrew waved at me, though of course he didn't. Even people who don't approve of the royal family probably remember any encounters with them. Of course, royals aren't the only ones to get this treatment in the modern world. The media feeds a widespread obsession with celebrities and even with their babies. Fortunately, those children are in the public eye only so long as their famous parents continue to shine. The spotlight moves quickly. In contrast, the experience of being born as the inevitable heir to the throne is impervious to the fleeting fashions of celebrity. A royal heir can't help but live out his or her life in the public gaze. This has been true ever since kingship was invented. Many countries around the world now have democracies, of course, and other forms of government that are not monarchies. But kings, and a few queens, remain on the throne in some places. Why do we have them? Why is it that through most of human history, the most obvious form of government was for one man to decide almost everything for thousands or even millions of people? How could that one person possibly convince an entire population of his right to rule over them? And how could he convince them that his son, simply by the fact of being born into his family, had that same right? The first kings on earth ruled in the ancient Near East, in Mesopotamia or Egypt. It's hard to tell which, because both happened around the same time. If Egypt had the first kings, then perhaps the Mesopotamians borrowed the idea. After all, they were in touch with Egypt in the period immediately before the first kings, during the Uruk era, from about 3800 BCE to 3100 BCE. Or perhaps the influence went the other way. Before the first kings, priests seem to have been in charge of organizing the population in the earliest cities. This makes sense. They were thought to represent the gods, and so it stood to reason that they could figure out what the gods wanted. But how did someone without that special relationship come to be in charge? One theory is that the earliest kings held the post for only brief periods of time, and only when they were needed for military campaigns. The word for king in Sumerian is lugal, which literally means big man. So perhaps a strong, charismatic man led the troops to battle against some neighboring city and stepped down when he was no longer needed. If the battles became more frequent, then perhaps the lugal didn't feel the need to step down. Perhaps he took the lead in negotiating with the enemy. Perhaps his troops felt a special loyalty to him, different from what was felt toward the priests. Perhaps the lugal's son took the role from him, because that's what sons did in the ancient world. They took the same jobs and responsibilities as their fathers. This is guesswork. But it does seem as though there were kings in Mesopotamia by around 2900 BCE. And once the role of king was invented, it became an inherited position and never went away, at least not until modern times. People came to expect the rule of kings. They were as much part of one's life as one's family and one's gods. It was simply a given that someone would be king. And the man with the most convincing claim on the position was the son, usually the eldest son, of the previous king. The time of Mesopotamia's earliest kings is known as the early dynastic period. It lasted for about 600 years, from around 2900 BCE. Unfortunately, scribes didn't really start writing anything useful about kingship until about 400 years after the first king started to rule. The Mesopotamians had a writing system, but before 2500 BCE, they used it almost entirely to keep track of accounts. By the time the king started writing royal inscriptions, the institution of kingship was so well established that no one would have had any notion of what came before. A much later document, called the Sumerian King List, begins with the idea that kingship descended from heaven, that the gods wanted humans to have kings. Obviously, we don't take this as a reasonable explanation, but that was what the Mesopotamians believed. The king's inscriptions, once the king started commissioning them, were written for the future and for the gods. And they weren't exactly objective. The kings wanted to be seen in the best possible light, so they didn't include any failures, and they probably exaggerated their achievements. But what we learn from these inscriptions is that kings had a great many responsibilities, and therefore they must have spent many years training to prepare for the throne. Their training didn't include what we would think of as schooling, though. Kings were usually illiterate, because the royal heir had more important things to master than reading and writing. By the end of the early dynastic period, the king's duties would have included planning and leading military campaigns, levying taxes, identifying the best men to serve as officials, but keeping them from gaining too much power, performing rituals to appease the gods, inspiring and controlling their subordinates, commissioning statues of themselves, planning and implementing building programs, forging alliances with neighboring states, choosing the ideal wife who had the most strategically useful father, and making good marriage alliances for their daughters. It was a lot to learn. Monarchs in all eras have shared one additional concern: maintaining a relationship with their subjects, one that provides the best odds that they will be able to stay on the throne. In the modern world, this mostly entails being popular. Most modern royal families are expensive. Unless they're loved, and unless their continued existence as an institution makes economic sense, bringing in tourists, for example, the tide could quickly turn against them. So they show up day after day to cut ribbons, open hospitals, and shake the hands of local heroes. Commoners who are present for these fleeting moments, or most such commoners anyway, relish being in the royal presence. They snap pictures with their smartphones and giddily share their experience with everyone they know through social media. Television, newspapers, magazines, and websites add to the constant stream of information about the royal family. They're omnipresent. In the ancient Near East, the relationship between ruler and ruled was more complicated. It's true that there were no republican stirrings. No one doubted that there should be kings. The tension they experienced was between accepting the rule of one particular monarch and supporting someone who wanted to overthrow him. The reigning king had to maintain a relationship with his subjects that discouraged rebellion and made any usurper seem less attractive. But the king couldn't do this only by being popular and visible. There were no ancient equivalents of photo opportunities or souvenir plates or guided tours through the palace. The king had only two choices, really. He could terrify his people into submission, or he could win them over by providing for them and protecting them and convincing them that he was on their side. Either way, whether he was feared or loved, or a bit of both, a king had a two-way relationship with his subjects. They had to provide for him, just as he provided for them. They had to pay their taxes, and they were required to show up, not just for military service, but also for what's known as corvée labor duty, a sort of national service work done by free men when canals needed to be dug or maintained, or buildings needed to be constructed. The subjects had to follow the king's directives and obey his orders, as well as those of his officials. One way that kings achieved this was to tell people that the gods had chosen the king for the role, and the gods would punish people who didn't follow the king. This wasn't just propaganda. It's clear that all the kings believed this deeply. Why would they have been born into the royal family if the gods hadn't wanted them to rule? Besides, various omens, signs from the gods, always supported the choice of the royal son as heir. And if someone who was not from the royal family did manage to usurp the throne, his very success was evidence of the gods' support. But it wasn't easy to overthrow a king, or to convince people that the gods wanted you to do so. Most royal families were able to pass the throne from father to son. In the early dynastic period, the kingdoms in Mesopotamia were relatively small. They're often described as city-states. Each king ruled a small state with one or two major cities and a number of smaller towns and villages. They were all located along rivers, either the Tigris or the Euphrates or a tributary, because the people needed river water for everything. Irrigation, transportation, drinking, bathing, fishing, you name it. There was no way to survive away from the rivers. Around the cities and villages, there were fields and orchards that produced crops. And beyond those were steppe lands that supported herds of sheep and goats. These were the basis of the economy. In each city-state, the king and his family lived in the capital, which was also home to the local god. For example, the moon god, Nanna, lived in the city of Ur, and the goddess Inanna lived in the city of Uruk. The god or goddess had a grand temple, usually near the center, not far from the king's palace. The god was believed to literally be present, taking the form of a statue. This is hard for us to wrap our minds around because most modern religions don't share this idea. But each god was believed to be in at least two places at once. The sun god, for example, was up in the sky, visible to everyone, but also present in human form in his statue in the city of Larsa. He needed all the things a human ruler needed, a home, clothing, food, and adulation. His home was the temple, and clothing and food were presented to each of the gods on a regular basis. The priests and priestesses provided all of these, along with incantations and hymns of praise. The kings of the early dynastic city-states credited the city gods with their prosperity and with their victories over their neighbors. But they and their subjects didn't think the gods of other cities were false. They believed in the power of all Mesopotamian gods. They also all recognized the superior power of the king of the gods, Enlil, who lived in the city of Nippur. The city-states, although they were independent of one another, had a great deal in common, not just their shared religion. Their populations spoke the same languages. These were Sumerian, which was dominant in the south, and Akkadian, which was more common in the center of Mesopotamia. The people dressed alike, built their houses and temples in much the same way, used pottery made in the same styles, and created very similar works of art. They also had a common curriculum that scribes learned in schools. The same lists of words copied by scribes as part of their training have been found right across Mesopotamia. But now the scribes no longer used writing only for administrative texts. They began to use their cuneiform training to immortalize the king's works. And we can reconstruct some details of the king's achievements and problems from these inscriptions. The administrative documents found in some royal palaces of the time also help with this. Let's look now at a particular king, Ornanshe, and his successors. Around 2500 BCE, Ornanshe founded a dynasty that ruled the city-state of Lagash in southern Mesopotamia. Lagash was rich, not just because of its crops and herds, but also because it was located on a trade route that led to the powerful land of Susa in the east. We know from images of King Ornanshe that he shaved off his hair and his beard. This bald, clean-shaven look was common among Mesopotamian priests of the time, though Ornanshe wasn't a priest. Mesopotamian men must have used sharp bronze razors to shave. The king wouldn't have done this himself. He had a barber. As you might imagine, the barber had to be someone the king trusted absolutely. In later times, the king's barber was often one of his closest advisors. King Ornanshe, in his most famous relief sculpture, is shown with a basket of bricks on his head. This relief is made of limestone, and it's now in the Louvre in Paris. It's unlikely the king actually carried bricks, but he used this image to remind people that he was a builder. This sculpture was probably created when he was dedicating a shrine to the city god Ningirsu. At the bottom of the scene, Ornanshe is shown again at a banquet with a cup in his hand. Perhaps this took place when the shrine was dedicated. Very few people could read, but you didn't need to be able to read in order to understand the basic message of this image. The king was pious, and he cared about his population. The inscriptions on the relief show that the other people depicted around him were his sons, his wife, and some high officials. They're all shown as considerably smaller than him. The inscription also says that, and I quote, Ornanshe, king of Lagash, built the temple of Ningirsu. He built the temple of Nanshe. Another interesting detail on the inscription is the note that boats from distant Dilmun carried the wood for him. This is the earliest mention of the land of Dilmun, which was located in what is now Bahrain in the Persian Gulf. It was a center of trade for hundreds of years, with goods coming all the way from the Indus Valley and then being shipped north to Mesopotamia, and it was already known for its boats. Another of Ornanche's inscriptions provides a long list of his building projects, including 9 temples constructed for various gods, a wall around Lagash, and 2 canals. Of course, he didn't do any of these things himself. He called up laborers and put them to work. The temple constructions were an investment of sorts. Gods given beautiful new shrines would perhaps be more inclined to give their support to Lagash and its king. The canals no doubt helped irrigate more fields and increase the productivity of the land. But his reign wasn't entirely peaceful. He fought and defeated the kings of 2 neighboring city-states, Ur and Uma. He says that he took the kings and a number of commanders captive and heaped up a burial mound. This might have been for the soldiers who died in battle. Ornanche doesn't actually say that he killed the leaders of the neighboring states. These battles were the start of a long series of conflicts that carried on after Ornanche's death, especially with the land of Uma. Ornanche's successors controlled Lagash for almost 200 years. 9 of his descendants ruled the region, one after another, in a remarkably stable dynasty, and almost all of them ended up fighting against Uma. Lagash and Uma each claimed the right to control a territory in between their 2 city-states, called the Gu-Edina. Most surviving inscriptions are from excavations of buildings that belong to Lagash. So, as a result, we have a rather one-sided story about this dispute. No doubt the kings of Uma felt equally righteous about their cause and felt their god supported them and wanted them to control the Gu-Edina. One of Ornanche's successors, a king named Eannatum, who came to power around 2450 BCE, memorialized his victory over Uma with an impressive stone inscription known as the Stele of the Vultures. It's largely broken, but we can still make out some of the main features. One side shows what seem to be historical events. At the top, the king is leading his troops into battle on foot. The soldiers are equipped with identical pikes, shields, and helmets, and they're lined up in a phalanx formation with their shields protecting them. This isn't a primitive band of warriors, but a well-trained, well-equipped, and coordinated army. The king probably didn't actually stand in front of the warriors. He would have been too vulnerable. But it's likely he did fight with them. In the second register, the victory seems to have been achieved, and the soldiers might be marching in a victory parade with Eannatum in a chariot as their leader. The third register is broken, but it seems to show a pile of dead soldiers and a bull. The bull was probably about to be sacrificed. The back of the stele shows the religious interpretation of this historical victory. The god Ningirsu holds a huge net full of dead enemies from Uma. So the king is giving credit for his victory to the god of his city-state, Lagash. The text of the inscription is even more interesting. It gives a historical account of past conflicts with Uma, along with details of the recent battle, Eannatum's victory. The border between Uma and Lagash was re-established as a result of this war. And the Gu-Edina region was once again inside the borders of Lagash. Eannatum didn't kill the king of Uma. Instead, he forced him to swear an oath. The religious object in front of which this oath was sworn was the battle net of Enlil. Enlil was a greater god than either the city god of Uma or the city god of Lagash, a fact that both kings would have acknowledged. When the king of Uma swore to Enlil that he wouldn't dispute the border, Eannatum might have had some hope that the border would last. This idea of calling on an impartial god to oversee a treaty was important. Sometimes the kings would swear by the gods of both lands instead of a greater god such as Enlil, the king of the gods, whose home was in neither land. But it wasn't good enough to invoke the god of just the lands involved. All the gods were believed to be real and very involved in the political affairs of their cities. You could also count on them to keep an eye on the kings and to make sure their oaths were obeyed. If you swore in the names of several of them, that raised the odds that they'd punish anyone who broke the oath. A later king, Eannatum's nephew, Entemena, continued to have problems with Uma, In one inscription, he mentions that he sent envoys to the king of Umma to negotiate. Here again, you can see that relations were complicated between these enemy countries. The kings negotiated truces at the end of each round of battles and spoke to one another through envoys. Entemena also had other troubles. He was worried about the king of another city-state, Lugal-Kagine-Dudu of Uruk, who had conquered a previous enemy of Lagash in the form of the city-state of Ur. Lugal-Kagine-Dudu seems to have been trying to take control of much of southern Mesopotamia. He even called himself king of all the lands, although this was definitely an exaggeration. Entemena perhaps worried about whether Lagash would be the next city-state to be attacked by Lugal-Kagine-Dudu. Entemena of Lagash worked to make sure this didn't happen. In several inscriptions, he boasts that he was able to conclude a treaty of brotherhood, that is, an alliance with Lugal-Kagine-Dudu of Uruk. This is one of the earliest peace treaties that we know of. Although we don't have a copy, it must have been negotiated by envoys who traveled back and forth between Lagash and Uruk, figuring out the terms. When it was completed, both Entemena and Lugal-Kagine-Dudu would have sworn to uphold it. Not only in the south did kings make treaties with one another and send envoys to negotiate. In Syria, hundreds of miles northwest of Lagash, kings of a city-state named Ebla did many of the same things. Ebla, too, had a long-lasting rivalry with a neighboring country. In this case, it was Mari, downstream along the Euphrates. The two kingdoms went to war over and over again. But they also made treaties with one another and with other cities. One treaty was found during the excavations of the palace at Ebla. It was drawn up between the king of Ebla and the king of a land called Abarsal. It's a big square clay tablet covered with small rectangles in columns. Each rectangle contained a word or a clause in careful cuneiform, and these were read from top to bottom. The treaty includes provisions about what each king should do if fugitives tried to escape from one land to the other. It also mentions the treatment of messengers. For example, it specifies that for 10 days after arriving in a foreign land, messengers would be expected to live on their own rations. And after that, they'd be given food by the king whose court they were visiting. Presumably, this would happen if they were waiting for the king to compose a letter in reply to their own king. So it makes sense that he would have to provide for them while they waited. A letter found at Ebla gives a little more information about this. It was from a steward of the king of Ebla to his counterpart in a distant land called Hamazi. The steward notes that he and his correspondent were brothers, equals, as were their respective kings. The man sending the letter asks the steward of Hamazi to send a number of donkeys and writes that in exchange he would send 2 wagons and 10 ropes. This, he said, was how brothers were supposed to behave. What is appropriate to brothers? Whatever desire you express, I shall grant you. Whatever desire I express, you shall grant. Another piece of evidence for relations between city-states was that the kings of Ebla sent their daughters to marry other kings. We know this from administrative records drawn up when goods were sent to the princesses living in their husbands' kingdoms. So, as soon as the Mesopotamians had kings, and as those kings started engaging in organized wars against one another, they also created a formal way of engaging in diplomacy. People always assumed that diplomacy was a late development, when in fact we have evidence for it at the same era as the early texts that provide the first written evidence for organized warfare. Early diplomacy had 5 specific components. The first was the regular exchange of messengers. The second was the agreement to abide by treaties that governed relations between the city-states, including treatment of the messengers. The third was the exchange of letters between the kingdoms. These were carried by the messengers. The fourth was giving luxury goods to one another in the form of gifts that the messengers brought almost every time they went to a foreign court. These gifts could be in answer to specific requests. And the fifth was the tradition of marrying an ally's daughter, or of a king sending his own daughter to marry an ally or vassal. These five conventions helped create orderly international relations for more than 1,000 years. We've seen how kings were believed to get their authority from the gods, and how it became normal for kings to inherit the throne. We've also seen that the early kings portrayed themselves both as warriors and as protectors of their subjects. But these early kings had a relatively limited amount of power, because their kingdoms were small. Some later Mesopotamian kings would use these same ideas about legitimacy and power to rule over much larger kingdoms, and eventually, empires.
Lecture 7, Early Dynastic Workers and Worshippers.
The world must have seemed very different to people who lived 5,000 years ago. So many things in life and nature were completely chaotic and sometimes terrifying. Imagine a person could suddenly lose a loved one to a crippling disease or an infection that seemed to have no reason or explanation. Babies often died during or soon after birth, sometimes taking their mothers with them. People could lose their crops or homes in windstorms or floods, and there was no way to predict when these might happen. Droughts began, killed thousands of people, and promptly ended, again for no apparent reason. In some years, the fields were thick with grain. In other years, some unseen force killed the plants indiscriminately, and families starved. Faced with all this uncertainty, the ancient people told tales, myths, and legends that tried to explain things. These stories often revolved around disasters. The Mesopotamians had one story about a flood that had killed almost everyone on earth. The Egyptians had one about a drought that lasted for 7 years. These stories were probably based on devastating local events in the distant past. Ancient peoples had no way of knowing whether everyone was affected by a disaster. They didn't have CNN, reporters calling from some other continent to let them know things were fine there, or satellite images that showed the extent of the damage. It was natural for them to believe the whole world was suffering from a flood or a famine. On top of that, storytellers no doubt embellished the tales as generations passed. We all make stories better the more we tell them. And grandchildren remember only the really exciting parts of their grandparents' stories. After a few generations, the details are likely to have become more exciting than the events were at the time. Today, we still fear natural disasters and epidemic diseases. But we take some comfort in the fact that, usually at least, we can explain them. Science has also helped protect us against many forces of chaos. We have fertilizers and antibiotics, food aid and surgery, weather forecasts, and hurricane warnings. We know that the Centers for Disease Control and drug companies are working on vaccines and treatments. And our life expectancy is much longer than theirs. For the first time in human history, we moderns don't necessarily expect the chaotic forces of nature to kill us or our loved ones. We tend to obsess more about politics than we do about plagues or floods. We expect fashions to change. And few people want their lives to be just like those of their parents or grandparents. We welcome innovation and cope pretty well with disorder. The ancient Mesopotamians wouldn't have understood us. Since the natural world was almost unbearably unpredictable, it seems as though they didn't want their personal lives to be unpredictable. So the early Mesopotamians created an orderly social world in which you could count on people to behave in predictable and civil ways. And almost everyone seems to have followed unwritten rules. This love of order pervaded everyday life in the early dynastic period, from around 2900 to 2300 BCE. One place where you see the desire for order was in religious beliefs. The Mesopotamians believed the gods had control over chaos and order in the universe. The natural world might have seemed completely unpredictable, but they could explain this. They believed that gods and goddesses, who were wildly powerful individuals, who shared our human virtues but had our weaknesses as well, they were in charge of it all. When the gods were angry, they could wreak havoc, causing all manner of natural disasters. When they were happy, they could be stable, maybe even loving. When the gods were content, crops were abundant, herds of sheep expanded, women gave birth to healthy babies, and the rivers rose predictably and didn't overflow their banks. So it was up to human beings to try to keep the gods happy. Being like humans, but on a much bigger scale in every way, the gods needed houses, food, drink, and gifts. Yet there were no guarantees. According to the Mesopotamian flood story, the king of the gods, whose name was Enlil, decided to wipe out human beings because they were just too noisy and he couldn't sleep. He wasn't successful. Another god, Enki, saved humankind by telling a man to build a boat to escape the flood with his family. You couldn't count on the gods to be predictable. The gods and goddesses looked like humans and were members of families. The families provided structure and companionship, just as they do for people. But the gods also fought and squabbled, just like family members. Enlil, as king and father of the other gods, commanded respect, at least most of the time. But sometimes, his divine children got rebellious and had to be reined in. One Mesopotamian creation myth tells of a time before humans had been created, when the gods rebelled against Enlil because they had to work too hard to produce their food. They were going to overthrow him in his palace. A wise god came up with a solution. The gods should create humans to take over all their hard work. Humans could feed all the gods with their farming and cooking. So the Mesopotamians saw their relationship to the gods in a unique way. Their sole reason for being on Earth, the reason for the creation of the human species, was to provide for the gods. All the chaotic things that the world could unleash, the floods and plagues and earthquakes and storms, those were proof of the power of the gods. The people were just insignificant servants tossed about by their immortal and fickle masters. But there was hope for everyone, because the gods, like humans, preferred order to chaos. One of the Mesopotamians' firmly held beliefs was that cosmic order was written on a document, a clay tablet, of course, in the realm of the gods. It was known as the Tablet of Destinies. People believed that it existed, even though it didn't. On this fabled tablet, presumably written in cuneiform, were written different aspects of cosmic order, which they called the Me. So long as a wise god like Enlil controlled the Tablet of Destinies, all was well with the world. On the other hand, all hell broke loose when the tablet ended up in the hands of an evil deity. Several myths describe how the good gods would get it back. The Mesopotamians just longed for structure and predictability in their lives and prayed that the tablet would stay safely in the hands of the father of the divine family. The Mesopotamian religion wasn't congregational and it wasn't dogmatic. People didn't gather together to worship the way that believers in religions do today. They didn't expect to get spiritual guidance in a temple, and religious leaders didn't preach. Normal people worshiped the gods privately, in their houses, or in small neighborhood shrines. Families were devoted to particular gods, and each individual believed that he or she had a personal god and goddess to watch over them. If you were having a spell of good luck, it meant your personal god and goddess were taking good care of you. If not, perhaps they'd abandoned you. Various incantations, which were like spells, could be recited to help bring back the gods. So Mesopotamians didn't go to big city temples to pray. A temple was the residence of a god. And where the god actually lived, that is, the sanctuary in the heart of the temple, where his or her statue was located, was as private as the house of a king, off limits to almost everyone, except for the high priests and priestesses. One thing many people did do in a temple was to work. By the early dynastic period, the temples to the great gods had turned into economic powerhouses. They owned vast estates with fields and orchards and herds of sheep and goats. The priests hired hundreds of workers to farm the land and herd the animals. Other workers processed the harvested wheat and barley into bread and beer. Lots of women worked for the temples to turn wool into textiles. They spun the wool and dyed it, wove it, and embroidered it. Textiles produced by women working in the temples and palaces became some of Mesopotamia's most important exports. Not just in the early dynastic period, but for thousands of years after that, people were willing to pay high prices for Mesopotamian fabrics. In Plutarch's Life of Cato the Elder, there's a reference to Mesopotamian tapestries in Roman times. We know about the early dynastic workers because the temples kept records of the people employed there, what they did, and how they were paid. Their pay wasn't in the form of money, because it hadn't been invented yet. Instead, they were paid in rations of barley, oil, and wool, enough to support not just the worker, but his or her family as well. The workers would use some of the barley to make bread and beer, and some of the wool to make clothes, rugs, and blankets for their families. Vegetable oil was used for eating and for light. This was before candles. They only had oil lamps. Sometimes the workers would have rations left over after using what their families needed. They could use this surplus to trade with other people for things they needed, like salt, and for cooking utensils and tools. Although grain was the only type of food they received in their rations, the Mesopotamian workers' diet didn't consist solely of bread. They also ate vegetables from their gardens. We know from later recipes that they were particularly fond of onions. They also fished in the rivers and made stews of the meat of wild birds. At religious festivals, they might eat beef or goat meat, though a goat or sheep or an ox was much more useful alive than dead. Dates from date palms, which grow across Mesopotamia, were the sweetest items in their diets. The Mesopotamians cooked dates in bread to make dessert. My students are often surprised to learn that Mesopotamians drank beer all the time. It was safer than drinking water because the fermentation process sterilized it. The beer had calories, that is a source of energy, and a low alcohol content. It was considered to be one of the most important aspects of civilization. People sometimes drank this beer through straws from big communal pots at banquets. The straws helped you avoid the sediment or the barley husks, or even insects that might have fallen in. An early dynastic temple that's been excavated at the ancient city of Lagash in modern-day Iraq had a whole area for brewing beer. There was a courtyard with ovens. One of them was 15 feet in diameter, and it filled a whole room. There was a large tank, and there were rooms with vats for storing the beer. Beer was made on a huge scale. Some of it went to the goddess Inanna, whose temple it was, and some of it went to the temple dependents and workers. Some of it might also have been sold. Women were often involved in brewing throughout Mesopotamian history, as they were involved in weaving. The female innkeeper was a common figure in Mesopotamian life. Actually, women could work in a number of professions. One of the most important roles was as a priestess. A high priestess had many duties, and most of them weren't religious. She could be responsible for running an entire temple estate. Just as large numbers of people worked in the great temples of the gods, large numbers of people were also employed in the royal palaces and estates. The king of each city-state had a palace in his capital city. He owned extensive agricultural land and herds of sheep and goats. And so did his wife. About 1,700 cuneiform texts have been found in the palace of the queen at Lagash. The king's palace wasn't excavated, but he would have had archives like this as well. The tablets were carefully written by scribes who kept track of tiny details. hundreds of tablets listed parcels of land that had been awarded to people who were dependents of the Queen's palace. Some of these were important officials, professionals and skilled artisans, military and cult personnel,